Chapter 52. With 5% on the innocence, A brought increasing to 7%. On roughing it, apostrophe and to 10%. On later books, Bliss had held that these later percentages fairly represented one half the profits. Clemens, however, had never been fully satisfied, and his brother Onion had more than once urged him to demand a specific contract on the half-profit basis. The agreement for the publication of A Tramp Abroad was made on these terms. Bliss died before Clemens received his first statement of sales. Whatever may have been the facts under earlier conditions, the statement proved to Mark Twain's satisfaction. At least, that the half-profit arrangement was to his advantage. It produced another result. It gave Samuel Clemens an excuse to place his brother Onion in a position of independence. To Onion Clemens, in Keokuk, Iowa. Sunday, October 24, 80. My dear bro. Bliss is dead. The aspect of the balance sheet is enlightening. It reveals the fact, through my present contract, which is for half the profits on the book above actual cost of paper, printing, and binding, that I have lost considerably by all this nonsense. $60,000, I should say, and if Bliss were alive I would stay with the concern, and get it all back, for on each new book I would require a portion of that back pay, but as it is this in the very strictest confidence, I shall probably go to a new publisher 6 or 8 months hence, for I am afraid Frank, with his poor health, will lack push and drive. Out of the suspicions you bred in me years ago, has grown this result, to wit, that I shall within the 12th month get $40,000 out of this tramp instead of $20,000. $20,000, after taxes and other expenses are stripped away, is worth to the investor about $75 a month, so I shall tell Mr. Perkins to make your check, that amount per month, hereafter, while our income is able to afford it. This ends the loan business, and hereafter you can reflect that you are living not on borrowed money, but on money which you have squarely earned, and which has no taint or savor of charity about it, and you can also reflect that the money you have been receiving of me all these years is interest charged against the heavy bill which the next publisher will have to stand who gets a book of mine. John got the stockings, and is much obliged. Molly wants to know whom she most resembles, but I can't tell. S. He has blue eyes and brown hair, and 3 chins, and is very fat and happy, and at one time or another she has resembled all the different Clemenses and Langdons, in turn, that have ever lived. Livy is too much beaten out with the baby, nights, to write, these times, and I don't know of anything urgent to say, except that a basket full of letters has accumulated in the 7 days that I have been whooping and cursing over a cold in the head, and I must attack the pile this very minute. With love from us, YF, Sam, $25 enclosed. On the completion of the Prince and Pauper story, Clemens had naturally sent it to Howells for consideration. Howells wrote, have read the 2 P's and I like it immensely. It begins well, and it ends well. He pointed out some things that might be changed or omitted, and added, colon, it is such a book as I would expect from you, knowing what a bottom of fury there is to your fun. Clemens had thought somewhat of publishing the story anonymously, in the fear that it would not be accepted seriously over his own signature. The L story referred to in the next letter is the one later used in the Joan of Arc book. The story told Joan by Glee Laxert, how he rode a bull to a funeral. To W.D. Howells, in Boston. Christmas Eve, 1880. My dear Howells, I was prodigiously delighted with what you said about the book, so, on the whole, I've concluded to publish intrepidly, instead of concealing the authorship. I shall leave out that bull story. I wish you had gone to New York. The company was small, and we had a first-rate time. Smith's an enjoyable fellow. I liked Barrett too. And the oysters were as good as the rest of the company. It was worth going there to learn how to cook them. Next day I attended to business, which was to introduce Twitchell to Jen. grant and procure a private talk in the interest of the Chinese educational mission here in the U.S. Well, it was very funny. Joe had been sitting up nights building facts and arguments together into a mighty and unassailable array, and had studied them out and got them by heart all with a trembling half-hearted hope of getting Grant to add his signature to a sort of petition to the Viceroy of China. But Grant took in the whole situation in a jiffy, and before Joe had more than fairly got started, the old man said, "Colin, I'll write the Viceroy a letter, a separate letter, and bring strong reasons to bear upon him. I know him well, and what I say will have weight with him. I will attend to it right away." "No, no thanks, I shall be glad to do it. It will be a labor of love." So all Joe's laborious hours were for naught. It was as if he had come to borrow a dollar and been offered a thousand before he could unfold his case. But it's getting dark. Merry Christmas to all of you. Yours ever, Mark. The Chinese educational mission, mentioned in the foregoing, was a thriving Hartford institution, projected 8 years before by a Yale graduate named Young Wing. The mission was now threatened, and Young Wing, knowing the high honor in which General Grant was held in China, believed that through him, it might be saved. Twitchell, of course, was deeply concerned, and naturally overjoyed at Grant's interest. A day or two following the return to Hartford, Clemens received a letter from General Grant, in which he wrote, "Colin Li Hung Chang is the most powerful and most influential Chinaman in his country. He professed great friendship for me when I was there, and I have had assurances of the same thing since. I hope, if he is strong enough with his government, that the decision to withdraw the Chinese students from this country may be changed. But perhaps 50. I Hung Chang was experiencing one of his partial eclipses just then, or possibly he was not interested, for the Hartford mission did not survive. XXI. Letters 1881, to Howells and others. Assisting a young sculptor. Literary plans, with all of Mark Twain's admiration for Grant, he had opposed him as a third-term president, and approved of the nomination of Garfield. He had made speeches for Garfield during the campaign just ended, and had been otherwise active in his support. Upon Garfield's election, however, he felt himself entitled to no special favor, and the single request which he preferred at length could hardly be classed as personal, though made for a personal friend. To President-elect James A. Garfield, in Washington. Hartford, Janey. 1281. Jen. Garfield, dear sir, several times since your election persons wanting office have asked me to use my influence with you in their behalf. To word it in that way was such a pleasant compliment to me, that I never complied. I could not without exposing the fact that I hadn't any influence with you, and that was a thing I had no mind to do. It seems to me that it is better to have a good man's flattering estimate of my influence and to keep it than to fool it away with trying to get a man office. But when my brother on my wife's side, Mr. Charles J. Langdon, late of the Chicago Convention, desires me to speak a word for Mr. Fred Douglas, I am not asked to use my influence. Consequently, I am not risking anything. So I am writing this as a simple citizen. I am not drawing on my fund of influence at all. A simple citizen may express a desire with all propriety in the matter of a recommendation to office, and so I beg permission to hope that you will retain Mr. Douglas in his present office of Marshal of the District of Columbia, if such a course will not clash with your own preferences or with the expediencies and interest of your administration. I offer this petition with peculiar pleasure and strong desire, because I so honor this man's high and blemishless character, and so admire his brave, long crusade for the liberties and elevation of his race. He is a personal friend of mine, but that is nothing to the point. His history would move me to say these things without that, and I feel them too. With great respect, I am, General, yours truly, S50. Clemens. Clemens would go out of his way any time to grant favor to the colored race. His childhood associations were partly accountable for this, but he also felt that the white man owed the Negro a debt for generations of enforced bondage. He would lecture any time in a colored church, when he would as likely as not refuse point blank to speak for a white congregation. Once, in Elmira, he received a request, poorly and none too politely phrased, to speak for one of the churches. He was annoyed, and about to send a brief refusal, when Mrs. Clemens, who was present, said, "Think I know that church, and if so this preacher is a colored man. He does not know how to write a polished letter, how should he?" Her husband's manner changed so suddenly that she added, "We'll give you a motto, and it will be useful to you, if you will adopt it. Consider every man colored until he is proved white." To W. D. Howells, in Boston. Hartford, February 27, 1881. "My dear Howells, I go to West Point with Twitchell tomorrow, but she'll be back Tuesday or Wednesday, and then just as soon thereafter as you and Mrs. Howells and Winnie can come you will find us ready, and most glad to see you, and the longer you can stay the gladder we shall be. I am not going to have a thing to do, but you shall work, if you want to. On the evening of March 10th, I am going to read to the colored folk in the African church here, no whites admitted except such as I bring with me, and a choir of colored folk will sing jubilee songs. I count on a good time, and shall hope to have you folks there, and Livy. I read in Twitchell's chapel Friday night, and had a most rattling high time, but the thing that went best of all was Uncle Remus's tar baby. I mean to try that on my dusky audience. They've all heard that tale from childhood, at least the older members have. I arrived home in time to make a most noble blunder, invited Charlie Warner here in Livy's name, to dinner with the Gerhardts, and told him Livy had invited his wife by letter, and by word of mouth also. I don't know where I got these impressions, but I came home feeling as one does who realizes that he has done a neat thing for once, and left no flaws or loopholes. Well, Livy said as he had never told me to invite Charlie and as he hadn't dreamed of inviting Susie, and moreover there wasn't any dinner, but just one lean duck. But Susie Warner's intuitions were correct, so she choked off Charlie, and stayed home herself. We waited dinner an hour and you ought to have seen that duck, when he was done drying in the oven. Mark. Clemens and his wife were always privately assisting worthy and ambitious young people along the way of achievement. Young actors were helped through dramatic schools, young men and women were assisted through college, and to travel abroad. Among others, Clemens paid the way of two colored students, one through a southern institution and another through the Yale Law School. The mention of the name of Gerhardt in the preceding letter introduces the most important, or at least the most extensive, of these benefactions. The following letter gives the beginning of the story. To W. D. Howells, in Boston. Private and Confidential. Hartford, February 21, 1881. "My dear Howells, well, here is our romance. It happened in this way. One morning, a month ago, no, 3 weeks, Livy, and Clara Spaulding, and I were at breakfast, at 10 a.m., and I was in an irritable mood, for the barber was upstairs waiting, and his hot water getting cold, when the colored George returned from answering the bell, and said, 'Colin, there's a lady in the drawing room wants to see you.' 'A book agent,' says I, with heat. 'Won't see her. I will die in my tracks, first.' Then I got up with a soul full of rage, and went in there and bent scowling over that person, and began a succession of rude and raspy questions, and without even offering to sit down. Not even the defendant's youth and beauty and seeming timidity were able to modify my savagery, for a time and meantime question and answer were going on. As he had risen to her feet with the first question, and there she stood, with her pretty face bent floorward whilst I inquired, but always with her honest eyes looking me in the face, when it came her turn to answer. And this was her tale, and her plea diffidently stated, but straight dash forwardly, and bravely, and most winningly, simply and earnestly. I put it in my own fashion, for I do not remember her words. Mr. Carl Gerhardt, who works in Pratt & Whitney's machine shops, has made a statue in clay, and would I be so kind as to come and look at it and tell him if there is any promise in it? He has none to go to, and he would be so glad. Oh, dear me, I said, I don't know anything about art. There's nothing I could tell him. But she went on, just as earnestly and as simply as before, with her plea, and so she did after repeated rebuffs. And dull as I am, even I began by and by to admire this brave and gentle persistence, and to perceive how her heart of hearts was in this thing, and how she couldn't give it up, but must carry her point. So at last I wavered, and promised in general terms, that I would come down the first day that fell idle, and as I conducted her to the door, I tamed more and more, and said I would come during the very next week. He shall be so glad, but, would you please come early in the week? The statue is just finished, and we are so anxious, and, we did hope you could come this week, and, well, I came down another peg, and said I would come Monday, as sure as death. And before I got to the dining room, remorse was doing its work, and I was saying to myself, damnation, how can a man be such a hound? Why didn't I go with her now? Yes, and how mean I should have felt, if I had known that out of her poverty yes he had hired a hack, and brought it along to convey me. But luckily for what was left of my peace of mind, I didn't know that. Well, it appears that from here she went to Charlie Warner's. There was a better light, there, and the eloquence of her face had a better chance to do its office. Warner fought, as I had done, and he was in the midst of an article and very busy. But no matter, she won him completely. He laid aside his MS and said, come, let us go and see your father's Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.